أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم أستغفر الله ربي وأتوب إليه الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على خير خلقه وخاتم الأنبياء والمرسلين سيد الأولين والآخرين شفيع المذنبين رحمة للعالمين محمد وآله الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد ربنا لا تزغ قلوبنا بعد إذ هديتنا وهب لنا من لدنك رحمة إنك أنت الوهاب. Assalamu alaikum, my dear brothers and sisters. So inshallah, we're continuing on from the first lecture. You're still here, so it's a good sign. So alhamdulillah, yesterday, just to give a brief summary, I just introduced the idea that can Karbala be not just a tragic event, but can it also be an intellectual event for us, where we extract deeper messages for scholars, for our community, and for humanity as a whole? And I gave two examples. One was in the British context, and I introduced in the 16th, 17th, 18th century, how key philosophers and poets saw Islam and how they translated it within their own context, which gives us an opportunity to do that here in Britain with Karbala. And second was the notion of human rights, which I extracted from the hadith of the 8th Imam alayhi salam. Continuing on from this, the other big theme that I guess we have to talk about is justice, is adl. And that theme of justice as to why Al-Hussein alayhi salam did what he did has to be arguably the first foundation that we have to start from in constructing this intellectual model or paradigm. And when we do talk about justice, we can talk about it very generally. And you can say Al-Hussein stood for Amr bil Ma'ruf, Nahy al Munkar, and we are facing injustice today. And this is what is often mentioned. But I think this is part of the problem. Because we don't connect very specifically the trends which happened in Karbala, and for example, the trends which happened in the Arab Spring, or which are happening in Bahrain, and I'm going to use Bahrain as a case study today, because we don't connect very specifically what was the Umayyad mentality, what was the notion of Sharia, how did they use these things in the constitution, because we don't connect these things, Karbala just remains as a very general event. And that's one of the tasks. We have to be very specific about what Al-Hussein did. And what did he actually do? And let me read out to you his words to Muhammad ibn Hanafiya, which I'm sure you know, but I think it's important to start with that. Al-Hussein said, "I have not risen against Yazid in order to create corruption or discord, nor to elevate myself in the eyes of the people, and nor to oppress. I have only risen to rectify the affairs of the Ummah of my grandfather and the affairs of the Shia of my father Ali ibn Abi Talib. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala. I wish to do Amr bil Ma'ruf and Nahy al Munkar. Ma'ruf, or enjoining that which is known or befitting or appropriate, we often translate as good, but ma'ruf also means a kind of consensus of the community, morals of the community, something which you also know. And nahy al munkar, prohibiting that which is detestable, that which is reprehensible really, something which you yourself find detestable and which the community finds detestable. Then he says, whosoever accepts my position, he will be on the side of Allah and the side of righteousness. Whosoever rejects me, may Allah be the final judge between them and me. And Allah is the best judge," he says. "Oh my brother, indeed success is from Allah. Upon him do I rely and unto him do I return." There's in fact a lot of depth to this, because the beauty of this last will or letter or last few words which he says, Al-Hussein alayhi salam is subjecting himself and his mission and his understanding of justice to God. What does he say? May Allah be the final judge between them and me. Now often we say that this is all willed. And even in the hadith yesterday, the 8th Imam said, well, this was destined. That's fine, there's no problem with that. But Al-Hussein is a human being. So every step of the way, when he's taking his family, when he's trying to conceive what is the best way to refuse this allegiance to Yazid ibn Muawiyah, he's a human being after all. So he says, whatever I'm doing, I don't want anybody to be hurt. Whatever I am doing, I want to make sure that I am actually being just. Because this is his human side. So he says, may Allah be the best judge between them and me. And I think that is beautiful, because people may look at that negatively and say, well, why should we limit Hussein? He's not limiting Hussein, he's elevating him. Because it shows that in every action, he had Allah in his mind. At every action, he had justice in his mind and wanted to be judged for his actions. Why should he escape judgment of Allah? He's a human being. That to me shows the greatness of Al-Hussein. And the second most explicit thing, we find these two notions, Amr bil Ma'ruf and Nahi anil Munkar. As I said, often translated simply as enjoining that which is good and prohibiting that which is evil. But is it really that? When you say Ma'ruf, Ma'ruf means known, really, or befitting. So that means what he did, he was expecting the community and the society to understand. That's the beauty of it. He's doing something which clearly he feels that the community would also find good. And he's prohibiting something which the community and the society would also feel bad. Otherwise you say that such a man would be insane. And that is why the people of Kufa were so regretful, so remorseful when they saw Bibi Zainab alayhi salam. Because they realized that what had occurred was something munkar, was something detestable really. So you can see that in his mind, he believed that there was a justice which people understood. And that means that we can discover justice and we can identify what is good and bad. That is why, again, why Karbala is relevant today. This is the basic mission of Al-Hussein alayhi salam. In a way, it transcends, if you like, sects and doctrines and many, many things. But this reflects the Quranic notion of justice. And I say this because in Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam's time, he had the same issue of trying to communicate what justice was to society. When the Khawarij decided to rebel against him and were quite violent, what did he say? He says in Sermon 125 that, O Khawarij, that this Quran is a book, only a book, which has got two sides or two flaps, two covers, that's it. And it requires the interpretation of human beings. In Sermon 176, he says a similar thing. He says, people wish to impose their desires on the Quran and manipulate it. And that's why today, when you look at certain terrorist groups, yes, I'm aware that, or we are aware that they may be funded by certain powers. But still, when they use the Quran and justify their actions using certain verses, that the Quran is commanding me to do jihad or bomb people or bomb towers, etc., then we have an issue as to how the Quran is used. And there's a reason I'm saying this, because Al-Hussein was reflecting the Quranic principle of justice. In one of his sermons, which I may say tomorrow, I think, he says that when the people of Kufa actually reject him or don't answer his call, he says, you people decide to take some parts of the Quran and reject others. That's how serious it was. So can you imagine, shortly after the Prophet, you would expect that the Prophet, who has left this spiritual and moral message, shortly after the Prophet, that basic message of the Quran had been manipulated. So Al-Hussein was in a way retracing the footsteps of our dear Prophet, trying to explain very simply what the principle of justice was in the Quran. I mean, you can imagine the state of Muslims at that time, really. And what does the Quran say about justice? What does it say? There are two words usually associated with justice in the Quran. You have adl and you have qist. And they mean very similar things, to be honest. Adl and qist have one foundational meaning, which is to be just, to deal fairly, to be equitable, to give due proportion if I owe you something, or to give just due. It also means balance as well. Both meanings are similar in that sense. Allah commands us, and I'm going to read a verse in a minute, Allah commands us to be just. But it appears that adl has a deeper meaning, meaning equilibrium and a kind of internal balance. A equilibrium and a balance of society and the individual. It's not just about me and you being just to one another, but society itself. Would you say British society is just? Maybe in some respects, maybe not in other respects. Would you say a society in the Middle East or Africa or somewhere else is just? It's about where is society actually going? Where are we going? There are so many things happening. For example, you look at trends when it comes to whether religion has any direct role in society today. When it comes to bioethical issues and how the nature of the family unit is changing. I think recently I received an email, I forget the bioethical term, I don't want to make a mistake, but there are certain changes within the modification of an embryo where you can have three parents. And the third parent can obviously just be a surrogate kind of person, but the other two, again, may not even be directly connected, and you have in vitro fertilization happening. Now, some of you know this, but there was one, I wish I had my notes here, but I'm just mentioning it, because one of the issues was that in vitro fertilization and surrogacy is one thing, but now you can have legitimately three parents which can have equal claim to the embryo or baby because of how it is modified. Now, I'm not trying to say what's right and wrong. Sometimes there's a maslihat, people can't be parents, etc. But the notion is, as a society, where are we going? And is it a just thing to do that to the child, to the parents, the family unit? So adl also means, where are we going as a society? It also means, how am I as an individual? Okay? One of the questions I recently had with an academic, I think it was last week, we were discussing whether akhlaq or morality could exist on a desert island. Could it? So if you are living alone, can there be such a thing as morality? Can there be such a thing as adl? Because justice, in a way, presumes that you can only be just when I do something to you. Maybe I insult you, or maybe I fulfill a promise. Then I'm being just to you and you're being just to me. But on a desert island, can a man or a woman have a conception of justice when no other life exists? And he argued, now I'm not trying, you can pick sides, you may think I'm wrong. He argued that on the desert island, there can be no akhlaq. And I said, what about justice to oneself? What about when you infringe your own nafs? What about if the man is eating really greedily? What if the man is walking in a naked way on the island or shamefully? Doesn't the man think that, or the woman think, that actually I'm not maybe eating in the right way? Maybe I'm being indecent with myself. What happens if I corrupt myself? So he disagreed. But I'm just saying it is a big discussion, because justice to oneself is a very big idea talked about by Zainul Abidin, alayhi salam, which I'll introduce tomorrow, where you actually owe duties and rights to your, even organs, to your hand and your tongue and these things. So again, it tells us that adl seems to have a very deeper notion here. And this is what the Quran says. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Inna Allaha ya'maru bil adl. Indeed, Allah commands justice, wal ihsan, and goodness. Wa ita'i dhil qurba, and nearness to the one who is close to you, like your kin. Wa yanha anil fahsha, and he's prohibiting fahsha, which is indecency and shame. Wal munkar, again the word comes up, and munkar, as some people translate, is actually shamefulness. It's like disgrace. So you can see when what Al-Hussein did, he was prohibiting shamefulness. وَالْبَغْيِ and rebellion. يَعِذُكُمْ لَعَلَّكُمْ تَذَكَّرُونَ and he instructs you so that you receive a kind of reminder. You can see how powerful these kind of verses are. That this justice is very broad and relates to shamefulness, relates to rebellion, and for us to take a kind of instruction. Salawat. Now, this is the basic concept of justice I'm giving you. So who are the Umayyads? The Umayyads were the absolute opposite of this. And Wilfred Madlung, in his book, Succession to Muhammad, says, in the face of the fake Umayyad claim to legitimate sovereignty in Islam as God's vicegerents on earth, meaning they were corrupting the institution of Khilafah, even the institution of prophecy, really, by claiming that Muawiyah or Yazid were legitimate caliphs. He says, and in the view of the Umayyad treachery, arbitrary and divisive government, so you can see what they were trying to do, and vindictive retribution. When you talk about martyrdoms and butchery, what we talked about yesterday, how Hussein was martyred or slaughtered like a sheep is slaughtered, there is this idea that there was a Jahiliyyah movement of killing in a particular way to mutilate bodies. That is why when we read the Maqtal, it is so distressing. Because you wonder what went into people's minds that Hind could eat a liver, or that people's heads could be beheaded, and that children could be martyred. There seems to be some culture of mutilation and butchery there. So he actually picks this up. There was a custom there. He says, in light of all of this, he says, they, the people, came to appreciate Imam Ali's honesty, his unbending devotion to the reign of Islam, his deep personal loyalties, his equal treatment of all his supporters, and his generosity in forgiving his defeated enemies. Look at the polar opposites at which Karbala stands. Karbala, again, in constructing this paradigm, it must be relevant not just to all Muslims but humanity. And it is difficult to say because, apart from Shia Muslims, most other Muslims don't really commemorate Karbala, giving it due significance. And we have to acknowledge that. Of course, we look at our own practices, what we emphasize, all of these things. But again, the polar opposites that Karbala stands in shows that it is such a significant event that Islam really was on the brink of being extinction. And therefore, I pose you this question. If we really believe all this, and we say this from time to time, what explicit connections can we make with Karbala to an event that is happening today, and how do we do it? And I want to mention the case study of Bahrain. And there's a reason I'm mentioning this. A couple of reasons, actually. One was because, by the grace of Allah, I had to write an article on Bahrain. I had to do some research. I spoke to a few people. It doesn't take a genius to figure out that Bahrain is ignored by the international community. One. Okay, fine. But number two, even when the uprisings happened in February of 2011, there were some divisions within the Muslim community as to how we should respond. Now, you may agree or disagree with me, but I went to certain institutions, I spoke to certain people, and there were certain different messages being given that some said, you can protest, but don't put it under the name of a Shia institution. That was one thing. Explicitly, I'm telling you this. The other was, okay, yeah, you can go and protest and we'll give aid and all that. The other person I spoke to who recently went to Bahrain said, that's fine, but no aid is reaching there anyway, and it's basically ignored. It's a huge issue, because one, it shows what is our responsibility, and do we have in our sciences, things when I talk about fiqh and aqaid, or if you go to university, what guidelines do we have as Muslims of how to act? And I always find this a very confusing thing. You might think it's a very simple question. Should I protest? Should I give in charity? Should I write? What should I actually do which gives my action value that I am somehow fulfilling Imam Hussein alayhi salam's oath and doing it in a legitimate way where my voice is heard? Is there something more intelligent that we can do? I'm asking you directly. Is there something we could have done and can do? Maybe we're not thinking about it. I gave the example about Islam and the English Enlightenment yesterday, where we could have made, and we can still make, a documentary which would enlighten even British people as well as wider human beings. Can we do something where we can think on a practical level about justice? And Bahrain is one of those countries where this year, on 22nd April 2012, the Formula One Grand Prix was held there. You may have read about it. And there was huge protest in April that this Grand Prix should not go ahead. It should not. Because there clearly are more pressing concerns going on in Bahrain to do with human rights, to do with political freedoms, to the way protesters are being treated. But alas, of course, the Formula One Grand Prix went ahead. Most of the international community didn't say anything, and that was that. And that's the reality of what's happening. So that means, in the interest of a few, or in the interest of the government, the Grand Prix actually happened. That is why today, when we talk about Karbala, we have to understand that satisfying the interests of a few becomes a huge problem. We start to make these connections. And I want to be very specific here. I want to read to you the Constitution of Bahrain, 2002. Okay? This is what it says. The regime of the Kingdom of Bahrain is that of a hereditary constitutional monarchy, which has been handed down by the late Sheikh Isa ibn Salman al-Khalifa to his eldest son, Sheikh Ahmad ibn Isa al-Khalifa, the king. Henceforward, it will pass to his eldest son, one generation after another, unless the king in his lifetime appoints a son other than his eldest son as successor in accordance with the provisions of this decree. Clear hereditary succession, okay? And what obviously happened, which I don't need to tell you, Muawiyah appointed Yazid. It's a very explicit connection, which we should be making through law, which we should be making by reading constitutions. If people are able to see this connection, they would see in history where or who were the rightful people that actually stood up against this Umayyad claim, which still has had repercussions today. And in the constitution, ironically, it starts off by saying that this constitution is there to serve God and to serve the people and to fulfill the obligations of Sharia. So now, how does hereditary succession and God actually come in the same sentence when or if the son perhaps is corrupt? We have to make these connections and write about them to again recontextualize Karbala in the 21st century. We can't be general. I think that leads us to more problems because we don't understand which part of Karbala is relevant. Salawat, please. The second thing is actually of human rights, which I think is very obvious, which I said yesterday, I don't want to repeat. But we know from reports, for example, that when the protesters did their protests, ambulances were delayed or denied to them, they were tortured or denied political freedoms. Again, similar things which I mentioned yesterday, that the denial of a fair trial, the denial of coming aid to the victims, Karbala becomes of paramount relevance. And what the other thing that happened in Bahrain, which again is a specific connection, is there was a grouping together of Gulf states, as you know, that they called upon Saudi Arabia to help them violently crush the protests. So Gulf states, which I think are six of them, got together, and I don't know if this has happened yet, but they were trying to make a Gulf Union. I don't know what the progress of that is at the moment. But I read a recent report, maybe a month or 2 months ago, that was a discussion very recently. If you look at what Yazid did, by gaining support of local governors and local regions, he tried to literally crush Imam Hussein alayhi salam and his companions. Again, another specific link that grouping together of people and kings and countries can lead to immorality. And in international law, we think international law, we have international human rights, I'm a British citizen, etc. A lot of people say that this is a myth anyway. There's no such thing as international human rights because it is manipulated by the will of political countries. And this is known as the struggle between state sovereignty and the international legal order. So now you can put it in the equation. Bahrain is a state. Maybe the people want to claim a sense of sovereignty. Maybe the people want to claim a sense of rights. But it is against the international legal order. Why? Because people don't want to recognize it. Or that people want to group together like Gulf states and crush protests. And that is what is happening. So people do say that international law affirms the voice of the majority and ignores the voice of the minority. Again, international law is another way by which we can make Karbala relevant. There are a couple of other things. The notion of Sharia. Now, let me just read to you what the Bahrain constitution says. The religion of the state is Islam. The Islamic Sharia is a principal source for legislation. The official language is Arabic. Then it says, we acknowledge of our obligations to God. How is Sharia being used today? We'll have many scholars, many students. I'm giving a very small lecture. People in academics, people in universities. People's voices, our community's voices, is very small. The people that are having voices as to what Sharia means are the people that are making decisions as to how Sharia is decided. And if they decide to manipulate Sharia by saying that Sharia justifies crushing protests, that it means either our Sharia is giving legitimacy to these actions, or that Sharia is simply wrong, or that they are wrong and Sharia is right. But again, understanding what Sharia is and talking about it and actually discussing it and not being afraid to talk about it is one of our other challenges. That's exactly what Muawiyah and Yazid were doing. They used the symbol of Islam and the institution of Khilafah to justify their actions. These are three explicit connections I'm making: hereditary succession, international law, and the use of Sharia. Now you might say, well, this is fine and it's very good in theory. What can we do about it? There are only a couple of suggestions which I have, and I'm going to read to you certain quotes, which in a way are favorite quotes of mine. One, because they are so bold and so courageous by the scholars. One is by a Muslim scholar, Ali Shariati, who I'm sure you've heard. And the other is actually by a professor in Birkbeck University called Kostas Duzinas. They virtually say the same thing. You'll be amazed as to what they are saying. And let me read you the quotes, and then I'll give you the implications of the quote, okay? This is what Ali Shariati said in his lecture, Mission of a Freethinker. He said, any school which is not based upon the cultural foundations of a society looks like a good book in a library, which is used only by a small group of students and professors. Even if thousands of such books are printed, they will have no effect upon the masses. I really should stop my PhD. The greatest danger, however, is self-separation of the free thinker from the society's context. If a free thinker separates himself from society, no matter where he goes or what he does, his society will remain in everlasting corruption. For example, in the 5th and 6th centuries AH, thinkers such as Avicenna, Ibn Sina, Ghazali, two of history's greatest teachers, died in a society which was wallowing in the corruption of the Seljuk and Ghaznavi periods. Because these free thinkers stayed away from the society, he says, consequently, we would have been better off if in place of Ibn Sina, Ghazali, Fakhruddin Razi, Zakaria Razi, we had one Abu Dhar, and we know who Abu Dhar was, a man that stood for the orphans and for justice. He says, if we had one Abu Dhar, all of the Islamic societies would have been saved from the grips of the Seljuk, Ghaznavi and the Mongols. That statement is so beautiful. I said yesterday, we live in a paradigm where we are operating through certain sciences. Oh yes, you become a faqih, you become a mutakallimun, you become a arif, you become a mystic, fine, no problem. But what is he saying? And what did the Prophet stand for? Prophet says, I have been appointed as a messenger in order to perfect people's morals. Makarimul akhlaq. That was the mission of the Prophet and that was the mission of Al-Hussein. Free thinkers, scholars, intellectuals have to balance their studies and their ideas by doing something practical and by creating a science which deals with justice. Do we deal in our Muslim community, in our Muslim houses and universities, how much attention do we pay to justice, to political philosophy, to applied ethics? Do we do these things? We have an idea of wilayat-e-faqih. It's fine, wonderful, no problem. But there are so many political theories. There's only one way of running a government. Maybe democracy is one way. Maybe you'll find another way in the future. Who knows? Why don't we devote time to these things in order that we remove orphans from the streets? In order that a government like Yazid can't come again? Won't we be accomplishing the mission of the Prophet? It's better to devote time to these things because then society elevates itself and we are fulfilling the mission of the Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. Why not? But in my humble view, I don't think we are devoting a lot of time to these sciences. And let me give you the quote of Kostas Duzinas. He says, like many others, however, I believe that this is the time for intellectuals and academics to join the wider political and cultural debates and conflicts and bring whatever limited insights of knowledge they have to the working of a better world. A better world. You and I, whatever profession we are in, whatever small we can bring to the table, doesn't matter whether we're a scholar or not. If it helps and results in a better society, then we have succeeded. Because then we have made sure that society is elevated and does not fall foul to discord and corruption. He continues, too often we academics, and look how he's criticizing himself, too often we academics have opted for a life of accommodation and non-confrontation. It's very easy to give a lecture. It's very easy to write something. He says, too often we have opted for a life of accommodation, looking for the next promotion or book contract. Too often has the university slavishly served the demands of the state, nation, and ideology. And yet, the prime mission of the university remains the quest of knowledge and truth. As we know, since Socrates, knowledge and truth are inseparable partners of justice and beauty. Truth and knowledge are wedded to justice. Speaking Truth with Justice to Power is the name and honor of the European University. What we are talking about today about Karbala does not just apply to us. Universities today have basically become business institutions. We know that because of the rise in fees. We know that because the little time professors have for their students. We know that because modules are based on demand and business interests. They're not necessarily based on knowledge. And today when we say, well, look at the greatest universities in the West or whatever it is, that's highly questionable. And I'm saying this because maybe I should have left university a long time ago and got a proper job. But I'm saying this having been stuck in academia for the last God knows 12 years, that really the university, when we say that this is the most wonderful thing, I'm saying it's questionable. Because its model now is become very much business oriented. It's got no connection, little connection with justice. If you walk outside most universities, you'll find students protesting. If you've ever gone to St. Paul's and you attended the protests, you will see how much they feel about whether they're getting knowledge, whether their livelihoods are being bettered. They're not. And because the university does not serve their life, they're going against the university. And now you think, what's the point of paying for education? Might as well teach my child at home if I've got the skills. Karbala can offer this because we can make sure that if Karbala is linked to these trends of knowledge, I gave the example of Bahrain, gave the example of Hosa, gave the example of university, then Karbala becomes irrelevant. It can become a very inspiring thing, actually. And you'll find that in university, departments are created. War studies, international studies, Holocaust studies, World War I studies. Why is that the case? Because clearly these events have had significance for people. So shouldn't we be proud of Karbala and let it inspire scholarship in us? So in GCSEs, why does anybody study World War I? You can study many events. One, because of there's a particular interest there. But number two, because it has some relevance for history and has some relevance for maybe understanding what justice is and injustice is. I'm just giving you some food for thought as continuing on the lecture from yesterday, that in constructing the paradigm, we can broaden it by making sure that justice is a key principle and it is accessed very well through these means, inshallah. Salawat. Jazakallah for listening. I think it's probably 5-10 minutes for Q&A, inshallah.
Any questions? Assalamu alaikum. Thank you very much for your talk. When we are trying to derive lessons from Karbala, how easy is it to be definitive in how we derive them? So, for example, the idea of hereditary leadership for being problematic and causing significant issues, as it did with Muawiyah and Yazid, might others take the example of Imam Ali and Imam Hassan and say, well, there is hereditary leadership, although we would argue differently, from there? So how do we ensure that we are deriving the true lessons of Karbala, not our personal interpretation of Karbala?
No, Jazakallah, it's a very good question. I agree with you that we have to stand back. And yes, it is an equally valid point that Imam Ali, Imam Hassan can be considered a hereditary succession. But as I mentioned at the start, I think underpinning that justice, or Amr bil Ma'ruf and Nahy anil Munkar are guiding principles, at least of Karbala, we should subject the Imams and the companions to the same level of rigor. And obviously, as you know, that is one of the criteria that we have, that an imam has to be pious and is also able to lead in that sense. And of course, there is Nas explicit designation, which is from our own perspective. But I think the only answer I can give there is we should be objective and we say, no, they are our leaders essentially because, first and foremost, they were ethical and they were pious. And I think that's the only answer which is perhaps viable. Because otherwise, I think, then we would be rather self-interested in that sense. I think, yeah.
You talk about the concept of justice, and I want to ask you about conceptions of justice, and whether you think conceptions of justice should change over time or whether they're fixed. And if I may give an example, so the verses of Quran that were recited yesterday were referring to what is lawful to you, and that includes your spouses and those whom your right hands possess. And there are countless verses in the Quran that talk about what your right hand possesses and that being lawful to you. How do we reconcile that, I guess, with the concept of justice? Mm. And is that a conception of justice for one particular point in time, or is it changeable over time?
Zakhla, it's a good question again. I guess so far it's looked at in two sides. One is that justice is fixed by the Quran, by the interpretation of Ahlul Bayt or companions if on the Sunni side, and because it's fixed, and from the Hadith, something like slavery, if it was actualized today as a widespread institution, you could then still free a slave in order to compensate for your fast. So slavery in itself would still be a valid thing to do. So that is one way, because there's a notion that Allah has revealed all that knowledge which is there. Maybe we can't access it, so we go by the literal dictates or etc. The other way to look at it is by your point, which is to say, well, justice is changeable. And in a way, we are applying it today with perhaps women's roles maybe changing, with the idea of rights, for example, or human rights. But then it comes to this issue, which is who determines which concepts and which criterion should lead justice? Now, one answer which you may not be satisfied with, but if there are very explicit verses in the Quran which we don't really understand, you keep those verses intact. But those verses, which may not be very strong in their explicitness or can be interpreted by hadith or require more usage of akal, then the human consensus starts to determine what standards of justice there are, like slavery or a woman becoming a leader or etc. like that, which obviously is one pertinent example of how maybe that wasn't in the Prophet's time, but a woman becoming a president of the community or these sort of things, which are now being more acceptable or being discussed, will say it was a cultural and contextual factor, maybe due to the lack of educational rights of women or how they were treated in that time. So the only answer I can give you is yes, it would be human consensus, but maybe still keeping revelation as some kind of guiding force, unless you have better...
Can I ask, so you would say that that was an instance of justice, and how would you argue with the point that someone might make that the whole point of justice is that it's supposed to right wrongs, and the context itself shouldn't be an excuse for why something happens. The whole point of justice is that it's supposed to try and alleviate something that's not right. Hmm. And so if slaves were maltreated, for example, then the point of a just God would be to improve their position. Hmm. And there are verses in the Quran that talk about improving the position, but I think... for example, there's verses that talk about do not sell them into prostitution, for example. Mm-hmm. But then the following part of the verses talk about how if you do, God will forgive you. Mm-hmm. So it seems like it's almost considered excusable.
I see.
So how would you respond to that? And would that be considered an instance of justice? And should we, as Muslims, try and defend those particular verses? Or should we... How should we respond to verses like that?
Yeah. First of all, I would say, how do we know what is right and wrong anyway? I mean, whatever we say about the Quran, we are giving meaning to the Quran. Whatever, like you interpreted the verse, that's your akal doing the work for it. Maybe you're right, maybe you're wrong, for example. So whatever we say about the Quran, like you said with the prostitution, that maybe Allah will forgive. Maybe I interpret differently, for example. But whatever this Quran is, which is not the Lohum Mahfuz, not the Umul Kitab there with God, but whatever the limited that we have in this book, we are doing all of the work in finding meaning. And it really comes to a more philosophical point that if the Quran is just a reminder, it's a reminder only to inspire and instigate our human condition and development. And our human condition development can grow, and people like Aristotle, people like Socrates, or people even in the Prophet's time may have found slavery to be a very normal thing. Maybe in their minds, like the Prophet said, no, it was not, it was actually wrong, perhaps, maybe I'm giving my interpretation here. And therefore the idea was freeing slaves was meant to lead to an abolishment of slavery. Now we may not know that 100%, but we have to make a decision either way as humanity develops. I personally think the question is dependent upon our development, personally. And I think that's the only way we can answer it. And standards will change. But if we at least keep the Quran as some kind of guiding force, at least we will can measure our views against something. Otherwise, it the other way, and a lot of reformist Muslim scholars will say, well, Quran has done its job, and really you rely on human consensus. But then you obviously you have issues of homosexuality and these kind of things which come in. But I don't know if I'm honest, that's the best way I can give you the picture of how it is happening. I don't know.
Firstly, I'd like to thank you for that enlightening lecture.
Okay.
I just had a quick question. You said you wrote an article about Bahrain. I wanted to know what's it called and where I can access it. As a Bahraini myself, I find it quite relevant.
Okay, well, hopefully you agree that my analysis of Bahrain is correct, because I'm not a Bahraini, but I did my research and spoke to some people. I wrote the article out of my heart in some respects, that if I'm going to choose a topic to write about, it should be something valuable. Inshallah, they've told me this, I hope, you never know. They said it will be published at the end of November, early December in, I think, Arches Quarterly. You may have heard of it. If you give me an email or leave it with Kumail or something, then I can email you when it's done, inshallah. Okay. Jazakallah. Inshallah, tonight, also I think the conversations are doing it, I'm not sure, but as we continue on in our journey of Karbala, the death of Muslim ibn Aqil was one of the most tragic. I don't know if we can dim the lights a bit or something, is it possible? Thanks. Al-Husayn alayhi salam relied on certain companions. And our dear Muslim ibn Aqil was one of them. And he had children. And we know that these dear children were also martyred. In fact, when they found out about their father's death, it is reported that they had a nightmare or a dream. Can you believe this? Where, in fact, they felt that now one of them will be martyred. Can you imagine a child who has found out that their father has been martyred, and now they themselves will be martyred and hunted down? The death of Muslim ibn Aqil was not just a tragedy to Al-Husayn al-Islam. It was a tragedy to his family. It was a tragedy to his poor children. When Ibn Ziyad found out that Muslim ibn Aqil was supporting Al-Husayn and still spreading the message, he made sure that he came to him and he made sure that he was tortured. And when Muslim ibn Aqil started to put up a fight, he got beaten up so badly, but he still managed to strike a blow. And it is reported that Buqair ibn Humran was the person that killed Muslim ibn Aqil. As they were in a state of struggle, Ibn Ziyad started to curse Muslim ibn Aqil, the Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt. Muslim ibn Aqil replied, "O enemy of Allah, do what you will. You and your father are worthy of this abuse." As he was taken up the tower, he said, "Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un," and he echoed the words of his Mawla Al-Husayn. He says, "O Allah, you be the final judge between us and these people who have summoned us, lied to us and betrayed us." Look how he was following Al-Husayn alayhi salam. As I said in my lecture, are we following Al-Husayn in society? When he was taken up the tower, he was taken by the head and he was made to kneel. Bouquet raised his sword and he started to raise his sword and he started to behead the head of Muslim ibn Aqil. Muslim ibn Aqil was simply chucked of the tower. And in this way, Muslim ibn Aqil's soul departed from the world. It is reported that Muslim ibn Aqil also had a daughter, Hamida. When Al-Husayn found out about Muslim ibn Aqil's death, he started crying. Tears rolled down his cheek and Hamida came to him. He put Hamida on his lap and he said, "Your father has passed away." She said, "Oh Husayn, who will look after me?" He said, "You do not worry. I will be your father. Bibi Zainab will be your mother. My brothers and sisters will be your uncles and aunts. Look at these poor children." And later on, what happened? The Muslim ibn Aqil's sons were hunted down. And when Muhammad ibn Ibrahim were there and one climbed on the other's back, they were killed in the same way of this butchery. Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un. May Allah give us strength to follow the mission of Al-Husayn today. Surah Al-Fatiha.